Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
This episode is brought to you by Navy Federal Credit Union. At Navy Federal, it's been the mission to help the military community for over 90 years. And not just help them, but do everything to make sure they not only grow, but flourish. That's why Navy Federal Credit Union has all kinds of great savings and investment options, like share certificates with sky-high rates. So don't hesitate. Start growing your finances today with a variety of savings and investment options. Navy Federal Credit Union. Our members are the mission. Savings products insured by NCUA. Investment products are not insured, not obligations of Navy Federal and may lose value.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and it is time to venture deep, deep into that vault.
That's right. This weekend, it is full of threads.
Threads. What's it going to be, Robert? I don't know. You're the one looking at the notes.
Oh, you don't know which one. Well, let me just say there's information contained within these threads.
Oh, this is the one we did about the Inca Kingdom of the Fibers and the Talking Knots.
That's right. This is from March 8th, 2016. And this one was just really fascinating because we get into this, essentially this entire kingdom that was built on fiber technology, from rope bridges that would connect an imperial highway system to fiber-armored soldiers, and even keeping all sorts of detailed information in the quipu system of knotted colored string.
I remember really enjoying this one, so we hope you will too. When did it originally air?
This one originally aired March 8th, 2016.
All right. Well, we hope you enjoy this visit to the Inca Kingdom of the Fibers.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick. And Robert, I've got a question I want you to think about.
Hit me.
Imagine somebody contracted you. I don't know if you've ever built anything like a shed or a house or anything like that. But imagine somebody contracted you to build something.
Okay.
Let's say it's a bridge. They want you to build a suspension bridge over a chasm. But there is a little qualifier on this request.
Okay.
You can't use any written down words. So You can't read any words and you can't write any words.
But I have to build a physical bridge.
Yes. So you need to get some workers together.
Right.
And you need to instruct them on how to build it. And you've got to get all your materials that you're going to need in order to build the bridge. And you might have to research yourself how to build a bridge if you've never done it before. And you can't use any written down words.
Huh. Yeah, that's going to be challenging. Like it almost makes the only alternative to be for myself to build it poorly without the aid of anyone else, because I'm going to have such difficulty in communicating with the workers. I'm going to have all this difficulty just acquiring the plans, acquiring the materials that I need. It's going to be a huge headache.
Okay. Now imagine on top of that, I also want you to organize a military campaign.
Ooh.
So you're going to need to get a whole bunch of people together and go raid a village on the other side of a river. You need to recruit your troops. You need to get provisions for all of them. You need to make sure they have food and weapons and everything. And you can't use any written down words.
I think this is really demanding a lot of me. I don't think this I don't see my empire growing too much.
I don't either. And this is one of the questions that we're going to have to confront in today's episode, because we're going to be talking today about the quipu, which are a fascinating record-keeping and notation system from the Inca Empire. And that still has many questions about it today, about to what extent it represents different kinds of information and what it can tell us about things that may otherwise be lost to history. So I want to sort of draw a picture in your brain to start off with.
Okay.
You are holding a woven artifact between your hands, and it's made out of hundreds of strings or cords. And it's very old, and it looks like it may have sort of succumbed to some, I don't know what you might call parasitism or predation on cloth over time. It might have some fungus or some insect larva in it or something like that. But it's made out of these very old strings or cords. It might be woven out of cotton, or it might be woven out of wool from a South American camelid like a llama or an alpaca. And it has one thick backbone cord stretching horizontally at the top, sort of like a clothesline. It might be about a quarter inch thick, so sort of like the cords that you would have in your electronics. And then down from that backbone cord hang lots of other cords with different characteristics. Some have different colors. They have knots tied all over them. They might have subsidiary strings hanging off of the cords. This is a quipu.
And if anyone out there has ever gone to an art museum and seen some examples of fiber art, particularly modern fiber art, with kind of an archaic look to them, that's the kind of sense you get looking at the quipu, because it's intricate looking, it's old looking, but you also, without coming in with some prior knowledge, it's very difficult to understand what it's for.
Yeah. So these quipu are so fascinating and enigmatic that I think they have inspired a lot of other designs and artists throughout the ages. Mm-hmm. And so the word quipu comes from – there are a lot of spellings of it, we should note. So if you're looking for it on the internet, you might have to try different spellings. It's K-H-I-P-U or Q-U-P-U, some other variations. But basically it comes from a Quechua word, and Quechua is an Andean language in South America, and the word means knot. And this makes sense because, as I've said, in the strings you'll see lots of knots tied up and down the length of the strings hanging off the top. So this is a very rare artifact in the modern day. Only some few hundred of them exist. We can talk about the numbers in a bit. And the basic terminology that we're going to use in the episode today for your reference is that this backbone cord at the top, sort of the main cord, is the primary cord. The ones that hang down from it with knots on them are called the pendant cords. And then some of the pendant cords are going to have subsidiary cords hanging off of them. And then there can be subsidiaries of subsidiaries of subsidiaries. And these things can get very complicated and huge over time. But the question, of course, is what does it do?
Yeah, because looking at one, you might think, well, this is some sort of an art mop or something, right?
Yeah.
Well, what are all the knots for? Why so many cords?
Yeah, it looks like it could be a garment. It could be like a skirt.
Mm-hmm.
You might have a grass skirt or something like that. Or it could be, yes, like you say, a mop, a cleaning instrument of some kind, or some kind of tool. But what everyone now agrees is that it was not these things. It might be a tool in one sense, but it's an intellectual tool. This collection of strings and cords with knots tied in them is a system of storing information, just like the hard disk on your computer or like a clay tablet or a paper document. It's for storing information that was useful to the Andean peoples who used it. So it stores information, but what kind of information? What does it say?
Yeah, we're getting into this area of pre-written language recording of information.
Yeah,
which is such a fascinating area because uh, you you're seeing the emergence of written language.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about notation, physical notation of information here.
Yeah, we're so used to the way our graphical languages work. I mean, I think that's the term we should use, graphical mm-hmm. languages, right? Because we represent them by making essentially drawings on paper
right.
or on another surface. You leave markings on a flat surface to indicate letters that we use as a phonetic system of communicating language. We operate by pictures, correspond to sounds of words, and those sounds of words correspond to ideas.
And we're so immersed in this system. I mean, it informs the way we think about the world
exactly.
as well as interact with it. So it is kind of difficult for a modern viewer, a modern language user, to sort of strip some of that away, to strip our written system away and try to imagine a world without it.
Yeah, and I want to get to the impact of physical writing systems on the mind toward the end of this episode. But for now, I think we should focus on the quipu itself and look at what this artifact is, what we can learn about it, and what the mysteries about it that remain are.
Yeah, and indeed where it comes from, because understanding the Incan civilization is also vital to seeing like how did this come to take place.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that's a great place to start. We should give a very brief, very cursory overview of the Inca Empire. Obviously, we can't get into all the fascinating details about this empire, or it would take over the podcast and become the whole thing. But to start off with, the Inca Empire was a civilization that occupied the Andes, the Andean region and the mountains in the west of South America in what is today Peru, Bolivia, Ecuador, Chile, Argentina. And in terms of sheer size, it was the single greatest empire in all of the Americas before the European invasion. So the Incas had this vast, powerful, impressive empire stretching all and down the west side of South America. When the Europeans arrived in the late 1400s, early 1500s. But according to the traditional understanding of the history of this pre-Columbian civilization, the Inca did not have traditional written records. They didn't have a writing system, or they certainly didn't have one of the kind that we can understand as graphical writing system,
right.
like markings on a page. And for a long time, it was thought that they didn't have any sort of writing system at all. And because of the lack of known historical or written records by the Incas themselves, a lot of the information that we have about Inca culture comes directly from the Spanish conquerors and colonists who came, beginning with Francisco Pizarro, who colonized South America in the 1500s and eventually brought the Inca Empire to an end. But we should talk about a few cultural facts about the Incas. Like one of the things to look at is what their religion and mythology looked like.
Yes, indeed. And they had a really, you know, fairly complex religious system. It was centered on the worship of the sun in the guise of the ancestor god Inti. But it also entailed a host of other pre-Inca belief systems, as well as a rich tradition of ceremonial magic, animism, dualism, cults of the mummified dead.
Oh, yeah.
And hopefully that is something that a future episode of Stuff to Blow Your Mind will get to as we've had some mummy episodes.
The mummies of the Andean civilizations.
Yeah.
This is
yeah.
fascinating. We should definitely come back to that.
Indeed. Magical items, divination, as well as animal and human sacrifice. Now, that god Inti, the ancestor god, is depicted as a human face on a raised blade disc. It's an important god of crops and life, and most of their major deities line up with what you would expect from an agrarian society, you know, the gods of rain, the gods of sun, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so the Inti, the face on the disc, that's sort of like a face in the sun, you're saying.
Right, yeah, the sun god, essential to everything.
Got to have one.
Right. But then there's also a god by the name of Viracocha, which is the creator god of the Inca, or at least the late Inca. And so the idea here is that he created the sun and the moon on Lake Titicaca. After his creation, he wanders the world as a bearded, robed man with a staff, teaching the ways of civilization to the people. So imagine sort of a South American Gandalf, I'm thinking.
That's amazing. So the creator god comes to Earth and wanders his own creation as a sort of itinerant.
Yeah, yeah. It's kind of like it reminds me a little bit of some of the later Dune novels. Right?
Oh, yeah. There you go.
But the other thing is this is a very ancient god, and he actually predated the Inca Empire. they didn't actually add him to the pantheon until much later, possibly under the rule of an emperor who took the name of the god Viracocha and died in 1438. So it's kind of this interesting scenario where it's a pre-existing god. It doesn't factor into the early Inca system, but then ends up becoming a dominant one later on.
Yeah. But of course, when we talk about the Inca Empire there, we're not just talking about the ethnic group of the Incas themselves, because they went on to create this vast empire that included many different regions of the continent and many different peoples. So they had a vast system of social and political organization.
Exactly. So yeah, it's like any kind of imperial religious system. There are going to be these other older religions that are playing into the popular belief system. There are going to be regional beliefs. There are going to be new beliefs. Suddenly gods that suddenly find a following with very important people. So yeah, it's a rich tapestry. Now, as for their overall political organization, they established their capital in Cuzco, in Peru, in what is now Peru, in 12th century. And they expanded via military conquest in the early 15th century, and within 100 years they gained control of the Andean population of about 12 million people total.
Yeah, and I've read many sources talking about the very hierarchical nature of the Incan Empire.
Yeah.
Like there were very clearly defined systems of who answered to who.
Yeah, it's easy to take sort of a Western approach to all this and view other civilizations and kind of imagine something kind of simple and primitive.
Right. They've got a pope and a king and all that.
Yeah, but this is really – yeah, it was a really rich system. And certainly at the top, it's headed by the emperor. But underneath the emperor, there's just a complete aristocratic bureaucracy, and there's and the military system that keeps a firm commanding hand on everything. And the divisions here involve the central government, quarterly governments, provincial governments, and what they call decimal administrations. And so, and the priesthood plays an important role in the structure as well, as does the military, and it all kind of just tightens the grip on most of the people in the empire who are just farmers.
Yeah. Now, as you mentioned earlier, there were hundreds of years of the Incas sort of expanding their power and capabilities. But as the actual official empire goes, it was fairly short-lived, officially lasting only from the early 1400s, I think the 1430s or so, until the Spanish conquest beginning in the 1530s with the last Inca resistance being destroyed by the Spanish in the 1570s. However, despite that short period, the Incas were incredibly productive in building this powerful technological civilization.
Yeah, in the same way that their religion was sort of pieces of things that already worked, so too their empire seems to be built of technologies that were already more or less in place. But then what they did with them in creating this unified structure is pretty amazing.
Yeah, I read definitely one scholar talking about how the amazing technology of the Inca was primarily an organizational or management-based technology.
Yeah.
What was amazing about what they did was their ability to organize groups of people to achieve ends, whether those ends are engineering or architectural or strategic social organizations or civic organizations, that they were able to mobilize people toward goals and get things done.
Yeah, because they already had – you already had the skills out there. You already had plenty of successful farmers. Mm-hmm. You had successful craftsmen, and then they were able to utilize these to create the infrastructure of empire.
Yeah, but just a few quick things to name about the Incan technological achievements. One, of course, would be their civic infrastructure. So the cities and the roads they have that span diverse climates and ecoregions and dealt with very difficult terrain throughout the Andes. I mean, they're building a civilization up and down the sides of unwelcoming mountains, you might say. But there is also the Incan road system, and this passes through the high Andes, the coastal desert, the lowland forests. It was complex and used traffic management. And then there's this one fact that often gets referenced because it's so interesting. They had a messenger system made of these messengers known as Chasquis. Have you read about these guys?
Yes, because they do tie in with our core subject here today.
Yeah, yeah. So these are lightning fast running messengers, and they carried information across these empire spanning road systems. And they would carry with them the subject of what we're talking about today. Like you said, the quipus, these strings and cords that had knots on them to carry information. And they would carry the quipus with them and they'd trade out with rested runners at waypoints. And they would bring information about state projects back to central administrative nodes like Cusco. And they could cover huge distances very quickly. An often cited number is that they could cover 240 kilometers a day on foot. Mm-hmm. And another thing I've read is that they boosted their high altitude sprinting power by chewing coca leaves to increase endurance and dull pains and hunger and thirst and to sort of focus. Of course, the coca leaves being the precursor to cocaine. And even here, you might say that this is a technological innovation in the use of nootropics or performance-enhancing drugs.
Oh, yeah. And of course, even to this day, you can it's sometimes recommended to have the coca tea if you're trying to adapt to high-altitude situations in South America.
Yeah. But of course, on top of all that, they had irrigation mm-hmm. systems, calculations used for engineering. The Incans had this interesting stone device called a yupana, which is, from what I've read, it's similar to an abacus. It was like a stone device they used for doing calculations. Also, one of the most impressive and interesting things to me is their bridges. They're just amazing.
Yeah, their bridges are really fascinating. And this is something I think I covered for the first time when I was working on how bridges work for HowStuffWorks.com. The Incans built the earliest known suspension bridges in the world out of twisted grass. Essentially, we're talking about fiber arts here. And this is where I get kind of excited thinking about them, because you think of this culture where, again, they're building the empire out of the existing tools. What are we good at? What are we great at?
Yeah.
And one of the things they're great at is crafting things out of fiber, out of string, out of rope and twine.
Yeah, I didn't even think about this connection until now, but we're seeing this notation system that we're mm-hmm. focusing on today made out of textiles. We're seeing major infrastructure like bridges made out of weaving. It's a sort of weaving-based technoculture.
Yeah, it's kind of like, to come back to that question you asked me at the beginning of the episode, you know, how would I do all these things? How would I build my empire if I couldn't use written language? Like the follow-up question might have to be, well, what are you good at? What is your primary skill that we could build all of this on?
Or more than that, what are lots of people good at?
Yes.
You know, what are the skills that we can get lots of people doing for the empire without having to teach them how to do it?
Yeah. So these bridges in question here, they were first discovered when Spanish conquistadors made their way into Peru in the year 1532. And they discovered this wonderful highway system that we've already mentioned. But as you mentioned, that highway system has to span some pretty treacherous areas, including some deep mountain gorges. That's where they discovered these suspension bridges, achieving spans in some places of more than 150 feet or 46 meters. In Europe, on the other hand, Europe wouldn't see its first suspension bridge until nearly 300 years later. So
wow.
they were building these fiber bridges to connect their highway system.
And if you're having trouble picturing this, I would recommend looking it up to see what they look like, because you can see pictures of them today.
Mm-hmm.
But also, essentially, it's a bridge hanging from ropes.
Yes.
That's what it is.
Yeah, and there is one left in the world.
You mean one Incan grass bridge?
Yes, one remaining Incan grass bridge, and it is the Quechua Chaca. There's like a single Inca bridge keeper named Victoriano Arespana, who I believe is still alive, still caring for the bridge. Because that's the other thing. If you're building your bridge system, if you're connecting your highways with rope bridges
mm-hmm.
in a climate like this, you have to continually care for them with a frequency that you maybe don't have to turn to as much with stone bridges.
Yeah, I was watching a video actually about modern upkeep of these bridges, and they don't just have to maintain them, they have to replace them frequently. So they'll at a certain period every number of years or something, I think maybe depending on the condition of the bridge, they'll cut it down and put up a new one.
Indeed. And of course, there are other areas where They're really using these fiber arts as well. So they're creating fiber boats out of reeds, fiber armor that's stronger pound for pound than the steel worn by conquistadors, woven slings that could supposedly split a Spanish sword with the stone that it fired. They also had burial and sacrificial textiles that were also quite important, which in a way that gets into our techno-religion episode of yore, right?
Yes.
Because anytime you have a culture that has some sort of technology, that technology is of course going to be used for religious purposes.
Oh, I'm going to get into that later.
And you know, textiles are so important. Textiles along with corn served as a kind of currency for paying the soldiers of the empire. So you're really to the point where you almost cannot overstate the importance of textiles and fiber arts and crafts within the Inca Empire.
Yes. But so reviewing all of these massive projects and achievements of this empire, I want to come back to that question I started with at the beginning, because the traditional understanding is that the Incas did not have a writing system, and they certainly didn't have a graphical writing system. And so if you assume that they didn't have a system for notation of words in any way, these achievements, they seem almost impossible to me. Like, how could it be done without being able to write down notes about how things should be carried out?
Well, it makes you think you're sending that runner off, right?
Yeah.
And you tell him, hey, I need you to tell such and such to the next village over. Make sure you remember it. Hey, we have all this string around here. Tie a piece of string around your pinky finger and that'll remind you. So how far could you extrapolate that system? You'd run out of fingers, but you still have all this string,
yeah,
right?
Yes, and that brings us back to the quipus that we're talking about today. Now, one of the central themes of this episode is going to be talking about the disputes about what is encoded in the quipus, what kind of information is in there. I think what's undisputed is that there is numerical information in there and that the quipus were used to keep track of goods and labor in society. So people living under the Inca Empire might have owed the state X number of days of work every month or something like that. How to keep track of the number of days you've worked and how many you owe. And then also people were organized into labor groups. You need census data to make organizational decisions about how many people you're going to have doing a certain project or available if you need them to fight in your army. And then, of course, the Incan engineers and architects needed to be able to make notes about the products of calculations used in engineering and architecture. And all these numbers we now know were encoded in the quipu. But is there other stuff in them as well? So here we should get into what the Spanish colonial authorities had to say about that. As we said earlier, for a long time, pretty much everything we knew about the Incas came from written records of the Spanish. And that's not a great situation to be in.
Right. Because you're depending upon the conquerors, the alien conquerors, to tell you how these people lived and what their not system represented.
Yeah, I mean, there are just different concerns. The Spanish colonists were very concerned about the glory of the Spanish crown, with domination, exploitation of resources, spreading their version of Christianity. So gaining a deep understanding of the existing cultures and their technology might not have always been at the forefront of their list of priorities.
Right. Yeah, I mean, the system itself does not prize that so much.
Yeah. But more recently, physical clues from archaeology have started to round out our modern understanding of the Incas. I think we're getting a better and more unbiased idea of what the empire looked like, but there's still so much we don't know. But so what did the Spanish chroniclers make of these quipus? Well, one of the things that I found is a collection of awesome illustrations that the Spanish colonists made of the quipus, explaining them. Just a few here from the 17th century, one group by Guaman Poma de Ayala and another group by Martin de Merua. Well, what are we seeing here, Robert?
Well, we are seeing drawings of individuals holding these quipus, which look, again, at times just kind of like mops. Like they're not the most detailed representations of what's going on. I mean, more so in the Merua illustrations than in the earlier ones. But then on the other hand, you do see an attempt to document and understand what's going on with this system.
Yeah, one example is it almost looks like a political cartoon. It's just sort of a black and white drawing of someone with a ponytail and a tunic of some kind holding one of these quipus, and then there's a little sign extending off of it that has the word for letter in Spanish, indicating that this collection of strings is a message that's being carried. So I think this is supposed to be an illustration of the Chaskis.
Right.
But of course, there are written accounts also. I want to read one quote from the Jesuit missionary José de Acosta, and this is cited in translation in the Encyclopedia of the History of Science, Technology, and Medicine in Non-Western Cultures, edited by Elaine Céline and translated by the entry author Molly Toon. So here's this selection. They are quipus, memorials or events registered in strings, on which diverse knots and diverse colors meant different things. It's incredible what they achieved this way, how much books can say about history and laws and ceremonies and business accounts. The quipus supply all this so promptly that it's admirable. In order to have these quipus or memorials, there were official representatives that today are called quipu camayo, who were obligated to give accounts of everything, like the public scribes here, and as such they have to be given full credit. For diverse genres like war, government, tribute, ceremony, land, there were diverse quipus or strings, and in each handling of these, so many knots and intricacies and strings were attached. Some were colored, some green, some blue, others white, and so many differences that just as we form 24 letters in different ways to make such an infinity of words, these knots and colors make innumerable meanings of things. And there are also stories of quipus being used for narrative purposes in other contexts. For example, somebody might be in the middle of a court case before a governor, and they have to bring a quipu out to give testimony in the court.
So it's serving as an official record of transactions or some sort of business history. The quipu is the recorded document. So we're seeing not only the externalization of human thought, but not only the use of the quipu as a way to remember something and convey information, but just to store it and immortalize it.
Yeah, and so the question here is, can we trust the Spanish understanding of what they claim to see? I mean, are these accounts accurate? Is it really true that you could take a quipu and read testimony from it? You could take a quipu and read histories of governments and even read religious things, ceremonial incantations, read all of these sort of literary formats from it? Can you fit a history into knots? And that's still the question for researchers in this area. So we'll get into the modern quest to solve the mystery of the knots in a moment, but first we should take a quick break.
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles in a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
All right, we're back. So we're trying to unlock the mysteries of the quipus. But one of the problems here, of course, is that the Inca Empire is long gone. Most of the quipus are long gone as well.
Yeah. So after the Spanish conquest of the region, the quipus were just used less and less frequently. And there are a bunch of reasons for that. There's probably some stigma against it because of the cultural power of the Spanish as the colonists. They didn't like these things. They thought of them as idolatrous. And so the Spanish, it is said, destroyed a lot of the quipus intentionally because, you know, they're blasphemy. Some were also probably destroyed by the Incas themselves during their own civil war. Many others were simply lost to time. Like, these are not stone carvings.
Right.
These are textiles, and they're, you know, they can be subject to the elements. And so almost all of the quipus we have available to archaeology today come from graves that we've opened up or come from private collections or museums, and they're originally of unknown origin. We don't know where they come from. So it can be difficult to figure out what the quipu was supposed to mean in its original context.
Yeah, we don't have the context. We don't have the record keeper to tell us what the notations are referring to.
Yeah. And so we're back to that big question. Are these only numbers? Are they only the raw data sheets for imperial accounting? Or do they contain words and calendars and genealogies and astronomy and royal history and literature and even poems and songs? And so for many years, scholars all knew that these systems of cords and knots were used for some kind of notation, but they were not able to translate or decode them. And eventually in the first half of the 20th century, that changed because a scholar named Leland Locke demonstrated conclusively to the academic community that the cords carried numerical messages in decimal form. However, Locke argued that these knots were used for purely numerical purposes. And so he was saying that, look, we can show how these things work to calculate numbers and to transmit numbers, and that's all they do. And this remained the dominant thinking for a long time. Most scholars were convinced by Locke's point of view that these didn't have stories in them. They didn't have words in literature.
Mm-hmm. But then, of course, in this we get into the bias of just approaching this with our own written language so firmly ingrained in our minds.
Exactly. So to answer this question, I think we should start by looking at how you read a quipu. And we should just start with the numbers because that's what everybody agrees is there. How do you read the numbers on a quipu? Well, we have a pretty good understanding of the numerical notation system, and I want to give a brief explanation that I got from a presentation given by a researcher named Gary Erton. And Erton is one of the foremost quipu researchers in the world. His name comes up a lot if you're reading about this subject. And Erton says that the quipu was probably the principal instrument of management of the Inca Empire. And it was used to manage numbers in the following way. So picture your quipu again. Put it up in your mind. You've got the big primary string hanging horizontally. Mm-hmm. And then down from that are your pendant strings with knots on them in different places. So the Incas, as we've said, they had a decimal number system. That's a base 10 counting system. It's just like ours. And the way the strings work is the placement of the knot on the string represents number places in the same way we represent them by the order of writing. So think of the number 537. You see that number written down and you instantly know what it means because the number the farthest to the right is the ones place. There are seven ones. And then the second most to the right is the tens place. There are three tens. Mm-hmm. And then the number farthest from the right is the hundreds place and there are 500. So it's 537. And there's a very similar placement system with the quipus, except it goes from the bottom of the string to the top. So a knot at the bottom of the string represents a value of one, the ones place. The next space up the string represents a value of the tens place, and so on like that. And then different types of knots represented different values in those numeral places.
So yeah, we can all easily imagine that, I think. And certainly you can look at some of the visual aids as well. Knots in the string representing numbers coming together to represent larger numbers.
Yeah, and there are some variations, but that's the gist of it. And we can be confident that we're reading the strings correctly because sometimes the strings are summed by other strings. This is one of the things Leland Locke showed. So that there might be, for example, four pendant strings, and then the primary string shows a number that happens to be the sum of all of the pendant strings put together. Mm-hmm. So that would be very, very unlikely to happen if we were not reading the numbers correctly. But even with the numerical notation, there's a question. Let's say you're looking at a quipu. You got a quipu in your hands and it might smell kind of moldy and, right. And it's this ancient thing. And you figure out by adding up the knots on it, you figure out how to read the knot placement. And there's 667 of something.
Okay.
What is the something?
Ah.
Is there more information to get out of a quipu, even if it's just meant for numerical notation, as the traditional hypothesis holds? And so one hypothesis is that the colors of the chords mean something. So maybe a chord that's red colored means some number of corn, ears of corn, and then a chord that's a different color means some number of peanuts or something.
Right. Because, the other idea would be that it would depend entirely upon the context that was known by the holder of the quipu.
And that is something that has been hypothesized as well. For example, some people might say that the quipu would require specially trained people to keep track of and orally transmit contextual information about the quipu. So, for example, these chaskis, the runners, the idea was that the runners would deliver the quipus for numerical data, but they would also orally relay messages contextualizing the numbers. So they'd hand off a quipu to you. It's 667, and they say, this is the number of times the emperor is going to kick you in the face if you don't do what he says, or this is the number of ears of corn he'll give you if you do what he wants.
So in this model, the quipu would not be, say, a more primitive substitute for written language. It would be a notation system that does not in and of itself tell the story or tell the complete data. It relies too upon the narration and or interpretation of another human.
Yes, exactly. And this is something that also might have been done by these people called the quipu camayuc, the knot keepers who were talked about by the Spanish, who specialized in creating and reading the quipu. So these were like the scribes who would be called out. If you needed a quipu read in court to give testimony, mm-hmm. The scribe would come out and explain what the quipu said. So the idea here could be that, well, maybe some of the information isn't in the quipu, it's in the scribe.
Right.
And the scribe knows, okay, this quipu means X, Y, and Z. So there's the possibility that the idea is just sort of hard-coded numerical data with oral metadata.
Okay. But then back to your point, though, that we do see colors. We do see other differences that go beyond the mere knots, right?
Yes, exactly. And one other very interesting fact. Speaking to the BBC in 2003, that scholar I mentioned earlier, Gary Urton, gave this figure that's kind of interesting. About two-thirds of the known quipu at that time – that number might have changed somewhat since then – but about two-thirds of them back then obviously consisted of numerical figures. They fit the standard scholarly model. You can look at the numbers and just count up numbers. Mm-hmm. But what about the other one-third? There's this other group of quipus that we have available to archaeologists that don't obviously just transmit numerical information. So what's going on with them? Are they saying something? And that's the big question that scholars are still trying to answer today. So one of the biggest steps towards discovering the other information contained in the quipu, if there is such information, is the creation of a standardized computer database of quipu descriptions, because it's very hard, mm-hmm. you know, like you don't know what information is relevant. So you're looking at a bunch of textile woven stuff and you're like, well, this one has kind of a frayed end. Is that something – could that mean something or is that just how it is?
Yeah.
And this one has an overhand knot. This one has an underhand knot in the same place. Is that meaningful? Is that coding some kind of something that would mean something, make sense? Or is it just an accident? So having a standardized database of descriptions, including basically all of the relevant information that you can state about these strings, allows people to cross-reference them and look for patterns, and especially allows computer programs to look for patterns in the strings and knots, because patterns are often the key to translation. For example, if you see a very commonly repeated pattern in something, even if you have no idea what the pattern means, you might start by assuming it represents a common word, like the name of an emperor or the name of a capital city or something like that. And so researchers have been doing this actually. More than a decade ago, Harvard University researchers Gary Urton and Carrie Brazine started doing computer analysis of quipu. And in 2005, they published research suggesting that introductory chords on some of these quipu might serve as toponyms, which would be like location tags.
Okay.
That would be the name of a place to show where quipu came from or what community it concerned. And if this is correct, this means that, okay, we definitely know there's some kind of notation in these strings other than mere numbers, the name of a place. And if there's a name of a place, there could be other words, right?
Hmm. That's interesting. Yeah, and especially, again, if you think back to the Inca as just as having such an expertise in textiles.
Yeah.
Like is textiles are going to speak to their masters perhaps in a way that they're just not going to speak to a modern observer, even a modern observer who has immersed themselves in the topic. And I also have to say that the idea of a modern computer essentially speaking or attempting to speak and communicate
right.
with this older form of notation, this older informational system, is just really mind-boggling. I just love to envision it.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And there's another really interesting development. This is actually – reading this story is what made me want to do this episode, that there's a very recent discovery that might help us crack the code. It might give us a foothold into looking for the Rosetta Stone of the quipu. So the discovery was that there's an archaeological site about 100 miles south of Lima, Peru, and it's called Incahuasi. And at this site, excavators found a collection of quipus in their original place of use. If you want to look this up, there's a great New York Times article on it called Untangling an Accounting Tool and an Ancient Incan Mystery from January of 2016. So the quipus in their original place of use. It was a storage facility for food crops. So they've got foods there like peppers, corn, beans, peanuts. And remnants of many of these foods have been preserved by the arid climate of the site. So we can still tell what crops were where in this storehouse. And this is significant because, as we said before, most quipus today, they don't come from their original context. They were buried in a grave with somebody.
Right.
Or they came from somebody's private collection and we don't know where they originally came from or what they might have meant. So here we can see quipus along with the quantities they're supposed to be counting, 667 somethings become 667 baskets of peanuts. And using this contextual information, archaeologists can look for physical signifiers in the quipus, like extra knots or knot orientation or string color that might correlate with what's being counted.
Yeah, something to say that this was not 667 peanuts, but 667 bundles of peanuts or something.
Yeah.
You know, there was some other detail that defines exactly what it's saying.
And so if they can find such details, that might correlate with what's being counted and, like I said, give us a foot in the door to start understanding non-numerical information hidden in the strings that we couldn't understand before. But I do want to also qualify it. Gary Ertin, that same scholar, he's quoted in the article, and he says it's not quite the perfect Rosetta Stone yet. So if there are any linguistic narratives waiting in the undeciphered quipus, we haven't found the perfect key to decoding them yet. Hmm. But that made me wonder, what would be the jackpot find? What is exactly what we'd like to find to figure out if there are literary histories and poems and stuff like that in the quipus? And I found a pretty good answer to this. In a 2003 news piece for the journal Science, Charles C. Mann offered that the best case scenario would be to discover a Spanish colonial translation of a known quipu. And then we really would have something like the Rosetta Stone. So the Rosetta Stone helped us discover how to translate hieroglyphics mm-hmm. by having the same document in hieroglyphics and then in Greek right next to it.
So what we need is a contemporary translation where a Spaniard essentially sat down and said, hey, explain to me what this quipu is saying. Show me what this quipu is saying. And then him recording it.
Yeah. And we would also have to have access to what the quipu was, either to actually have the quipu still or to have a complex description of what was on it.
Okay. So both of these things have existed and to have survived.
Yeah.
Okay.
But if we had such a thing, we could form the basis of a lexicon. Unfortunately, we don't think there's anything like that. Mm. Unless I should mention that I should mention this, though, it's a kind of iffy road to go down.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
So there is one set of colonial documents out there, or claimed colonial documents, produced by the Neapolitan amateur historian Clara Micinelli in the 1990s, which claims to include an original historical account of the literary contents of quipu. And so it explains that some quipus contain a secret phonetic rendering of the Andean language Quechua, which we mentioned earlier. And they say that certain physical markers on the strings represent syllables of the language. So that would be actual phonetic language, not just not like a symbol, not like a knot means a word, but like a certain symbol on the rope means a sound that you make with your mouth.
So what's the problem with this document?
Well, if it were true, it would be a huge discovery. But this collection of documents has been regarded with what I would describe as serious skepticism by the scholars I was reading. I haven't seen any Andean scholars talking about it in recent publications. Almost everything that mentions it says, I don't know, this looks kind of iffy. So it doesn't seem to me like the academic community is persuaded that these documents hold any value. They might be forgeries, or they might the documents might be really historical, but they might have been forged at the time they were created. But if you want to learn more about that, you can Google the Micinelli documents or the Naples documents, and that'll turn up some leads for you. So the mystery of whatever literary content the quipus contain is still a mystery. We don't have the answer yet. Who knows? We may never have the answer, or we may find out that, you know what, it's all just numerical notation. In fact, there is no literary content there. But I hope that's not the case, because it really would be amazing to suddenly uncover the meaning of all these documents that contain the history we never got from the Spanish.
Yeah, and you know, you want that culture to still have a voice in our world, despite what was done to eradicate it. And that also gets to another area here, is that, and one of the other just huge tragedies of any of the American cultures is that we'll never know where they would have gone, what they would have developed into.
Right.
Without this outside context event of the colonial invasion.
Yeah. I mean, what would the Incan culture have looked like a few hundred years down the road if not for the introduction of smallpox and the Christian mission and the military conquest of the Spanish? It's hard to say, but it would have been fascinating to learn that.
Yeah, because fortunately, we can look back to other physical notation systems in history, and we can actually see how they developed and look at how they seem to have played into the development of written language and numbers as well.
Yes, exactly. So if you do think of one possibility about the quipus being a sort of proto-writing system, like maybe it wasn't fully able to communicate literary content yet, but it had some literary content, like it had some words, but not the whole language represented. That has some parallels that we know about from other times and places in history.
Yeah, particularly if we go back to Neolithic Mesopotamia, particularly we're going back to around 7500 BCE. And this is where we saw the use of clay tokens in accounting. So These were clay tokens, and they were inscribed with recorded information about traded agricultural goods. We see the use of small geometric clay objects throughout the Near East in this period, and it's all serving as ultimately as a precursor to writing and mathematics.
So this is sort of like the traditional understanding of the numerical quipu. It's trying to use a notation system without writing yet.
And of course, in both cases, agricultural is tremendously important, both to the Inca and to the ancient Mesopotamians.
Yes.
Because remember, it wasn't just that we learned to cultivate crops and domesticate animals. These technological advancements changed the shape and the scope of human life. It demanded new systems of thought, and the clay tokens were a part of this.
Yeah, I would say one thing that seems significant with the introduction of agriculture and domesticated animals is that you're not concerned with what you're eating today. You're
right.
Concerned with all the things you have available to eat in the future.
Exactly, yeah. So with the earlier tokens, it's a pretty basic model. The more primitive tokens, you have like a token with a sheep on it, and that
like
clay
a picture of a sheep.
Yeah, a little picture of a sheep, and that means, hey, this represents one sheep.
Uh-huh.
And that is essentially a pictogram, all right? You have a symbol that represents the thing that it is.
Yeah.
So like if you have a picture of a dog, that is a pictogram representing a dog. But then the tokens get more complicated. They begin to represent multiple items. So you might have a token that would have multiple sheep on it, and that would represent multiple sheep, the number of sheep represented there.
Now, what if you just sort of like drew extra sheep on you?
Well, we will get into some of that because that would be wrong. That would be counterfeiting, Joe.
Yes.
But as the cities develop, you get more and more complex tokens. Tokens that are not only representing more of one item, but are essentially breaking off from the idea of a mere pictograph to the idea of a pictogram to an ideogram, which is a symbol that represents an idea.
Okay. So there's a level of abstraction there.
Right. Like a classic example of this would be, to go back to the dog, picture of a dog. That's a pictogram or a pictograph representing the dog. But a picture of a dog with a circle and a slash through it, that of course means no dogs. And that's a rather simple thing, but it's the next step in symbolic representation.
Oh, yeah. It makes sense. It introduces abstract negation.
Yeah. So these were used for – these clay tokens were used for trading and record keeping. They were strung on strings in some cases.
Huh.
Each end of the string attached to a clay bullet that sealed the deal. So this would keep you from tampering with it. So you have like six sheep. You put – and that's the number of sheep involved in this deal or whatever.
Uh-huh.
Then you join the strings. You seal it with clay. Nobody can take any tokens off or put them on.
You can't cheat by adding beads.
Exactly. Then they also had another system where they stored the tokens in clay envelopes. But then, of course, one of the things here is you put the clay tokens inside a clay structure. How do you know what's in there? Well, you take – but before you seal it all up, you take the tokens and use them to mark the outside of the clay envelope so that people will know exactly what's in there. So – but then again, you have a sealed record of something.
You know, all of this discussion makes me think about a really interesting concept that I'd like to do a full episode on sometime, which mm-hmm. is how physical writing systems affect the way we think.
Yeah.
I know there are a few studies along these lines. Like one of the things I read just poking around real quick on this subject is about how the direction of a writing system changes how we envision the passage of time. That's just one simple example. But I'm sure there are tons of examples. If you're a literate person and you interact with reading and writing on a frequent basis, I think that probably has some effect on how you interact with the world, on how your mind perceives especially abstract concepts. So the question I have is, because almost everybody today who is literate, who uses reading and writing, uses graphical reading and writing, mm-hmm. markings on a page. Now, you might have some differences in that, like maybe writing that goes from right to left or from left to right. That's one thing you could look at. But how would it change the way your mind interacts with the world if your physical notation system of reality is based in strings instead of in making markings on a page?
Indeed, yeah,
or in clay tokens.
Yeah, how does that change the way you think about the world, talk about the world? Do you live in a world of trying to imagine the Inca mindset, where agriculture and textiles are such an important aspect of your world, and then how are they informing your view of reality itself?
Yeah, I would love to see the sort of the differences in imagination, say, that are present between a person who uses standard graphical writing systems and someone who is maybe a novelist who works in strings. Would that change how the way a novel unfurls, the way the story is told?
Yeah, like just thinking back to what we were talking about earlier about the wandering god of the Incas, Viracocha.
Yeah.
Did he, in sort of modern Western ideas of a god, sometimes you hear, about like the Book of God, right? And he has a book and he's writing people's names in it.
Yes.
So did this god of the Inca, the wandering god, did he have a quipu? And then what did it consist of? What kind of information would be bound up in its knots?
Oh, no. Is your name written or not written? Is your name tied in the quipu of life?
Yeah. And, another area where all this talk of clay tokens and quipus and written language, another area where this I can't help but think about is our increasing use of emoticons, emojis, and also just memes and GIFs to convey our emotional responses to different scenarios and bits of information on the internet.
Yeah. One of the things that's true about memes is that many of them are linguistic in nature, so they'll have text on them.
Right.
But plenty aren't.
Yeah.
Plenty are just pictures, reaction GIFs.
Yeah.
That's huge on the internet.
Yeah, like the it's kind of exploded into its own thing, but the whole John Travolta wandering into a room confused.
Uh-huh.
There's no text there, but it conveys a little something more than merely, hey, I don't understand, more than just putting a row of question marks in response to something, right?
Yes.
There's actually a brilliant short. I don't know if you've seen this yet, but it aired on the Colbert show.
Oh, yeah. You sent it to me.
Yeah. And it's like a little skit. And the idea is that Facebook is rolling out an additional feature as a follow-up to their reactions deal, where the reactions thing, of course, is where they took the thumbs up and they augmented it so that you can do like a heart or a angry face and a few others.
I'm laughing.
Yeah. So this skit involved Facebook rolling out something called Facebook Alpha, which is essentially them recreating the use of the alphabet, saying, "Hey, we have each one of these stands for a different part of a word, and you can
26 symbols that you can now use to show your reactions to things."
Yeah,
I loved how they were like, "You can in fact represent the entire works of Shakespeare using only these 26 symbols."
Yeah, so I'll have to link to that on the landing page for this episode at stufftoblowyourmind.com, because if you haven't seen it, not only is it a wonderful send-up of emoji culture, it also ties into some of the origins of written language and some of the earlier notation systems that we're talking about here.
Yeah. There's one more interesting fact I want to get to before we finish out is that I don't know if you got a chance to read about this, but there are some quipus still in use in modern times. And so you would be thinking like, oh, well, if there are people who know how to, write in the language of quipus today, why don't we just ask them to translate?
Yeah.
That's not exactly how they're used today. Instead of being used for literature or record keeping, they're used for ritual power. So the example I read about was a University College London project page about how in the Peruvian Andes, there's this mountain community called San Cristobal de Rapaz. And within this village, in a protected ceremonial building known as a kahawai, the villagers have been keeping this gigantic quipu object for ritual and ceremonial use. And this one giant object is believed to be collected from a large number of smaller quipu over the years. Some parts of it are older than others. Some might be more recent. But what really struck me is the way it was used. And I want to read a quote from this UCL project page. Where they say, a number of rituals happen inside the kahawai. Their most important aspect is la búsqueda del tiempo, which could be translated the search for weather when the mountains are invoked to bring rain. Participants bring offerings like oils, rewains, which is crop offerings, coca leaves, kunuk incense, tobacco, liqueurs, flowers, guinea pigs, etc. And the main ritual is the Rewan Entrego, which happens on the second night of January. At this time, the members of the committee that oversees the use of the pastures around Rapaz are rotated. The kipu are not handled, they're only invoked. Their presence is considered beneficial to the rituals themselves and to the success of the political changeover.
Huh.
So this makes me think about in what ways the functional technologies of one era become the holy relics of the next. Like, which of our functional technologies could become an item of religious significance in the future? This would be sort of like if our Excel spreadsheets became holy objects in the
right.
future. or if you take the hypothesis that there's more literary information in the kipus, even if our, you know, books or something, even if we couldn't read them, we just had books put up somewhere as holy objects.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this gets right into the subject of grimoires that I covered with a Christian about a year back, where the book becomes more important as a symbolic representation of the data within it and the power within it and the meaning within it, as opposed to just a mere physical record of the thing.
Yeah, once again, we're seeing this fascinating line that runs right through between the sort of mundane usage of technology to the holy power of religion and all of the symbolic territory in between. I love these types of subjects, and I loved getting to talk about the Inca today.
Yeah.
I think this has been really cool.
Yeah, I mean, really, hopefully, among other things, this will give you a little more respect for this fabulous culture and sort of a amalgam of cultures that came before.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you're one of the people out there who's working on this research to try to decode the quipus and find out if there's literary information in there, and if so, what it is, We wish you all the best, and we can't wait to learn more.
Yeah. Hey, in the time being, if you want to check out more content from Stuff to Blow Your Mind, head on over to stufftoblowyourmind.com. That is the mothership. That's where you'll find blog posts, podcast videos, links out to our various social media accounts. We are Blow the Mind on Facebook and Twitter. We are Stuff to Blow Your Mind on Tumblr. And hey, and if you want to physically send us some sort of Kipu inspired creation to convey your appreciation for the podcast, you can find the physical address over at howstuffworks.com.
And of course, as always, if you'd like to email us with your thoughts or feedback about this episode or any others, you can get in touch with us at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 G's in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.